On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we talk about the New York Mets, who have lost 11 games in a row and were just swept by the Chicago Cubs. But they were not the only team swept this weekend. As the Braves sweep the Phillies, the Yankees sweep the Royals, the Reds sweep the Twins, the Cardinals sweep the Astros, and a whole lot more action from a wild weekend in Major League Baseball. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks the New York Mets might be in a little bit of trouble. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And losing 11 games is not exactly a way to get your fan base fired up.
11 games in a row, my friend, step right up and beat the Mets. That's what April is all about. As the Mets have lost 11 games in a row, and surprise, surprise, that is our opener.
The 1961 song, Meet the Mets, has indeed become an anthem for this franchise, a song written before the Mets even existed as a way to introduce New Yorkers to an expansion franchise. But right now, those who bleed blue and orange across the tri-state area would prefer to have never met the Mets at all. As this ball club is a, I'll say it, revolting excuse for a baseballing organization, it has gotten unbelievably bad as the New York Mets were swept over the weekend by the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field to complete an 0-6 road trip and to push the club's losing streak to 11 in a row, and things in Queens are not good.
We sat here on these microphones a week ago and we said, oh no, the Mets just got swept at home by the A's. That's not great. Surely their road trip where they go play the Dodgers and Cubs will sort things out. And shockingly, that was not any sort of antidote, as the Mets were swept in Los Angeles and now swept in Chicago, as you mentioned. How did it happen, Jake? Give me the recap of these three additional losses to tack on to this miserable losing streak.
The first game of this set featured Kodai Senga, a man who I thought was hashtag back. I sat behind the dish at spring training in Port St. Lucie, and I watched Kodai Senga throw 98. And I said, boy, oh boy, that'll help this club. He was butt once again, allowing 7 runs. The New York Mets offense tallies 14 hits, scoring just 4 of them, which is hard to do. The Cubs also have 14 hits with 3 homers and win. In a rout 12-4, game 2, Jameson Taillon shoves, allowing 1 earned over 6. Freddy Peralta, good as well, but Brooks Raley comes in and allows a 3-run bomb to Carson Kelly on the first pitch he throws. Mets manages 2 extra base hits. The Cubs win 4-2. Game 3 on Sunday, MJ Melendez, the hottest Met right now, as we all expected. He is a solo blast. And the pitching is good as Tobias Myers and co. go 8 scoreless. But that 1-0 lead does not hold as Devin Williams allows a single to Ian Happ and then a double to, of all people, Michael Conforto to tie the game in the 9th. Mets can't score in the top of the 10th. Cubs walk it off against Kimbrel in the bottom with PCA, the former Met, scoring the winning run. And the Mets schneid will never end. What a series it was, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
We will, of course, give the Cubs some credit here in a few minutes. But when your losing streak reaches 11, I don't really care who you are. Double-digit losses in a row is a remarkable achievement in the opposite direction.
You did it.
And for the Mets, who have not lost 11 in a row since 2004, with the amount of talent on this team, even factoring in the very expensive player that is injured, several players that are injured, but Juan Soto obviously not playing right now, This is really something. This is really something, folks. They are 7-15 on the season. They are tied with the Kansas City Royals for the worst record in baseball. And on April 20th, are already 8 games back of the first place Atlanta Braves, which is really, really hard to do. We will, of course, give Atlanta some credit. And Phillies fans, you're not off the hook either. As you're probably well aware, we'll talk about the other marquee series here in the NL East shortly. But it's just all going wrong. When Juan Soto got injured, we looked at this offense and we said, okay, well, Juan Soto covers up for a lot. And while there is a lot of talent here, a lot of these accomplished players have not really hit their stride yet, whether that was Lindor, who was homerless, Bichette, who was certainly struggling. Luis Robert Jr. looked great. Polanco, not really getting going, clearly injured. Now he's on the IL. And a lot of their homegrown guys, besides Alvarez, who has been terrific, but Beatty, Vientos, certainly not really crushing the ball. And then Benj, who they were really counting on, not doing so awesome. Yeah? Who am I forgetting?
Vientos not really crushing the ball, undersells it. I think he was on like a 1 for a whole bunch streak before he went yard.
All of these Mets are alternating 0 for 20s at this point. So, yes, Vientos has been especially bad, but he is not unique in that sense. The offense has certainly been the story in terms of the ineptitude.
It's been the problem.
They have not scored more than 5 runs. They've scored more than 5 runs one time during this losing streak, and that was this 11-6 loss against the A's. But other than that, we got in order 2-1-0-6-0-0-1-2-4-2-1. I mentioned on Friday that during the skid they had a 35 team WRC plus, which maybe I was exaggerating a little bit, saying that's like hitting like a pitcher. But it's not far off, and when you have this many purportedly good hitters in the lineup, that is impressively bad. So I know you're considering going up to New York to get a closer look at this situation now that you no longer live there, and maybe you're not getting a sense of the day-to-day. Yeah. But watching from afar, what are some of your big picture takes? Because I certainly have one, kind of just looking at how this has gone.
So there's two things that come to mind. And the first is that the offense is so bad, it doesn't matter the order that you put these players in. And it highlights just how important Juan Soto is to this entire operation. And when they were building this roster, it really did revolve around Soto being Soto, which I think is fair. But when you build a roster that depends on one person to, one, be healthy, and two, be brilliant, there is risk associated with that. I think that Soto is as reliable of a fulcrum as there is in our game, but still there is risk. And the second thing that I have gathered, and this is more from the Mets fan point of view, is that the frustration here, while very real, is it carries this air of like distantness, an air of unfamiliarity, because the players that are doing all this losing are not like long-time Mets. Fans do not have emotional connections to Bichette and Semien and Robert, who's been good, and Peralta and Polanco, even Benj, right? Where it's like they're watching a bunch of strangers wearing the uniform that they like lose a bunch of baseball games. And I think that makes this even weirder. And I would say worse. Because if you were watching, you know, McNeil and Alonso and Nimmo go out there and do this, you could say, oh, well, these guys have been awful for as Mets for stretches in the past. And in 2024, they pulled themselves out of it and they did this amazing thing. Mets fans can't do that with this group. They have nothing to fall back on, but President of Baseball Operations David Stern's repeated pleas for patience. Pleas that have grown more and more tiring and tired and falling on more and more deaf ears. And so that is all to say, I can only imagine how odd this must all be for Mets fans who are surely struggling to find a reason to care.
That is a perfect transition to the point I was going to make, and really, really sets it up nicely, because with all the caveats that it is still mid-April and their season isn't necessarily doomed, and Juan Soto is such a big part of this, and you get credit for paying Juan Soto the most money, because when he's on the field, he does keep you in a place that essentially almost no other hitter can kind of keep you in, because he's that good. This is a fantasy baseball team. This is a team mashed together, perhaps for good reason, because of how this last era ended. It's not that the idea of shaking things up was wrong to begin with, but it is going to take some time. That was probably always going to be true. But you just made the right point. What are you, you think about what the fans are leaning on. I'm thinking about this, and this is maybe where I'm stretching a little bit too much, and this is where I think you getting some up-close reporting on this and understanding is probably more fair than what I'm about to say. But I also do think about it from a human perspective. None of these people, think about it internally, none of these people know each other. They all just got there. And so who's leaning on who? Who's friends with who? Yeah, you have some of this core of Alvarez who's been there with Beatty, and those guys have come up together, and maybe they've gotten to know Benj, and in theory they look to Lindor, and he's, you know, the guy that's been there during this era of Mets baseball. And the pitching staff, there's a little bit more continuity. But as you mentioned, the main characters involved here, all of them just got there. All of them are still getting to know each other. That also includes the coaching staff, right? I mean, it's like there's so many pieces here that are still feeling each other out, probably as teammates, as people who are spending the entirety of their, or so much of their time together every day, showing up to work, trying to figure out how to win Major League Baseball games. And you just look around the diamond and it's just, it's natural. How would you expect there to be chemistry? Now, sometimes the talent is so good that it overwhelms it. And maybe we will see that from
and
the Mets
that's what we've
at some point this season. Yeah.
That's what I think is my biggest takeaway from the early going, is that the talent on this team is not good enough to overcome the lack of institutional familiarity, the growing pains with all these new faces, that I think it would be 11 losses in a row. No, I think this taking a bit is not the most shocking thing in the world, but it has just shown up in such a destructive way on the offensive side where this team just can't score any runs. One last dynamic that I think is worth highlighting is they did bring in veteran faces here. I think that Polanco, Bichette, Semien are all respected vets to varying degrees with different personalities and whatever. Those three guys have been awful. Horrible.
Awful.
Bichette is a 538 OPS. Semien's at 606. Polanco, 532. He's now on the IL. It doesn't matter how much of a leader you are for most guys. If you're not performing, you're not going to be as, like, aggressive, as insistent on, you know, keeping things on the rails or interacting with other players as you would be when you're hitting well. Now, that's not the case for someone like Austin Hedges, who's never hitting well. But if you're Semien, Bichette, Polanco, it's difficult to pull Carson Benj aside and give him tips when his OPS isn't that much lower than yours. I mean, actually, wow, it definitely is, because Benj has been a disaster. But you get my point. That you are only able to impart knowledge is like your the back of your baseball card speaks louder really than anything else. And so now what? I mean, I think that's the last point, is like, what happens now? I think it's just Soto is the force that brings them up. I think that Lindor, the way that Lindor has performed and looked over this stretch, and maybe I'm being too harsh, has, especially from afar, now that I'm not there every day, has fundamentally changed the way that I think about Francisco Lindor. Is that an overreaction? Like, he's looked so discombobulated at a point where this franchise and this roster needs him to be steady and reliable, and he just hasn't been that. And so, if not now, then when? You see what I'm saying? Now, I don't think this makes him a bad player or a bad person or a bad leader, blah, 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 blah. I'm saying that, like, this is why Francisco Lindor is supposed to be Francisco Lindor. And he just, I'm not even talking about the 72 OPS plus. I'm talking about the mental mistakes and just the lack of locked in-ness that he has displayed over this stretch.
And that's why I was going to bring him up when you mentioned these other veterans that have come in. no matter how those guys were hitting, it was still going to be Lindor's team and Soto's in theory, but Lindor in particular, in terms of the face, the voice of it, that I think from a vocal leadership standpoint, our understanding that Semien's probably closer to a candidate to be that than Bo and Polanco. Polanco and Bo yeah. considered plus makeup guys for different reasons. But I think your point is spot on. And I think that that circles back to Lindor where, okay, even those veterans are probably going to defer to the pace that Lindor is kind of setting. And so far, like the rest of the team, that has been very bad. And so when you mix in some inconsistencies on the mound from like a moment when you have Devin Williams, who also just got there, blow a game like that. And Devin Williams, that's all these tough. Guys are going out there and saying the right things. Yeah. But as you mentioned, the Mets fans themselves have no reason to give all these new, fresh, well compensated players the particular benefit of the doubt if they haven't gone through the Mets experience with them the way that Nimmo and Alonso and McNeil and so on have.
Oof. That's all I have to say.
So
is oof.
I have one more thing. Yeah. So oof is right. This is brutal. The season is spiraling. Let's take a look at the schedule. Okay.
Yes. This is
when you're playing this bad, you're clearly capable of losing to anybody. However, in theory, the window is here over the next few weeks to get back on track. They have a 9-game homestand coming up against the Twins, the Rockies, the Nationals, and then they go on the road for 9 games for the Angels, the Rockies, and the D-backs. As we have seen, those teams are honestly all across the board friskier than we thought they were when we started the season, where we thought we were maybe looking yes. at like clearly a few of the worst teams in baseball. And they still kind of might be that in the case of the Nats and whatnot. So these will not be gimmies by any stretch, especially if they cannot score at all. But there is a path. This is not, okay, we've lost all these games in a row and now we have to go play the Dodgers and Cubs. This is an opportunity to get right relatively. But until Soto's back, I know, you know, Mendoza shuffled the lineup and so on. I just need some of these accomplished guys to start doing what they've been doing in their career. Otherwise, this is going to get even uglier, even if they can start winning some of their games, because now you're in a point where playing 500 ball is not going to be good enough. So they're going to really have to catch fire, and there's time to do that. A lot of baseball left. But they're not giving us a lot of reason to believe. So that's where the Mets are. But we should probably talk about the team that beat them 3 times as well.
Very briefly, kudos to the Cubs. And I know the Cubs are on a W5, but this series was about the Mets losing more than it was about the Cubs winning.
Sure.
The Cubs are good yep. once their big dudes of, you know, Bush, Bregman, Suzuki, PCA get rolling. They could be really dangerous. The pitching staff's a little thin, especially after Cade Horton went down. I'm actually going to be in Chicago in a couple of weeks, so I will get a look at the Cubs then. But for now, the NL Central is an unexpected wagon, but the Cubs are doing a totally fine job of holding serve.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the NL Central a little bit more later on in this episode. But before we do that, let's stay, before we take a break, let's stay in the NL East, because there was another big result over the weekend, another sweep that I think in a lot of weeks, had the Mets even won one of these games, right? We're probably leading with the Braves sweeping the Phillies in Philadelphia. But the L11 has to take precedent. But it is related to these two teams, the Phillies and the Braves, who are heading in very different directions. And a Phillies team, which is certainly benefiting from the Mets being an even bigger disaster, but by some measures, the Phillies have been worse. I mean, the Phillies have the worst run differential in baseball, not just in the division. And why don't you tell me how this weekend went for those Phillies against the Atlanta Braves, who are one of the best teams in baseball?
It went very poorly. They lose the opener 9-0. Martin Perez shoves. Very bizarre week for Martin Perez. The Braves DFA'd him, floated him through waivers. Nobody picked him up. He was like a free agent for 5 minutes. They bring him back as if nothing ever happened, and he dominates the Phillies. Taiwan Walker, not very good. 2 homers from Austin Riley. Dom Smith also goes yard. Michael Harris. Game 2 was a battle of the Southpaws. Chris Sale against Christopher Sanchez. Felix Reyes hits a home run in his first career AB. Just is Felix Reyes kind of like a Franmil Reyes type, just like a big, powerful bopper with hit tool questions. Bad in Mundo says Sosa error kind of breaks the game open a little bit. Phillies only get four more hits. It's all singles. Braves win 3-1. Game three, Schwarber goes yard in the first inning. And that's mostly it. Braves put up a 3-run fifth inning off a shaky Andrew Painter. Grant Holmes is solid for Atlanta. Acuna robs Schwarber with a nice catch for the final out. Could have been a game-tying double, and the Braves win 4-2, completing the sweep. So let's start with what's going well for Atlanta, and then we'll do what's going wrong for the Phillies.
The Braves are pitching it, folks. I know they have a bunch of very talented arms on the injured list, but that has not seemed to matter at all, as they have a 2.66 team ERA, which is far and away the best mark in baseball. The Pirates and Mariners tied for the second best at a 3.22. Chris Sale has been great. Grant Holmes has been rock solid. Bryce Elder, no matter what you think of his peripherals, has seemingly unlocked something to become a legitimately solid pitcher. He's only allowed 2 earned runs in 23 innings. Reynaldo Lopez has been solid, as you mentioned. Martin Perez has shockingly given them 20 decent innings. And the bullpen, besides their lefties, Aaron Bummer and Jose Suarez, who have both been not so great. I guess Dylan Lee has been very good. But Robert Suarez, who they gave a bunch of money, has been awesome. Raisel Iglesias, who they gave a bunch of money to come back, has been awesome. Tyler Kinley, who they traded for and then re-signed, has been terrific. And enough of their hitters, think about how disappointing this Braves offense has kind of been over the last couple seasons. Obviously, injuries have contributed to that. But so far, pretty much everybody is hitting. Mike Yastrzemski has been disappointing. That's someone who I think they were really counting on, especially after Jerks and Profar got suspended for the whole year, which is, I think, important context
Dom
to
Smith,
just remember here. We'll get to Dom Smith in a second, but just remember like the vibes and Ha-Sung Kim slips on ice and Jurickson Profar gets suspended for the whole year. Even though I think we thought the Braves were going to be better because it couldn't have possibly gone much worse last year, it's not like spring training gave us a lot of reasons to be like, hell yeah, the Braves, because of the pitching injuries that they had, because of what happened to Kim and Profar. And now Yastrzemski gets off to this really cold start. But Baldwin is amazing. I can't speak. I mean, I'm just the biggest Drake Baldwin fan. Ozzie looks much better. Matt Olson being awesome is not surprising. He's always terrific. But Michael Harris is starting off well. Acuna hasn't even really gotten going. And then Mauricio Dubon, who I think we expected to just be chilling at the bottom of the order, playing some good defense and occasionally hitting singles, has inexplicably been one of their best hitters. I don't necessarily expect that to continue, nor do I expect Dom Smith to finish with a 998 OPS, but he has stepped in this DH role and supplied some pretty big swings, which Dom Smith, one of our favorite humans in baseball, is very cool to see him have that that role for Atlanta. So filling in for, as we've seen, Marcell Ozuna, who's been filling that DH role for the last few years for Atlanta, Dom Smith's been great. So They got a lot of things going well. I think there's certainly some parts of it that look a little bit, like Dubon and Smith and some of the pitching is like, oh, I don't know.
Perez.
But a lot of it is like, no, these are good players. This should be a good team. And I don't think we should be that shocked from that perspective.
So I was just curious. This is a little nerdy. So if you're not a nerd, you can tune out. I was just like, what is Bryce Elder doing differently? Like, how is this? And he's throwing a ton of sliders. And that is weird for a right-handed pitcher to do against left-handed hitting, right? Not many guys, you see this more for lefty arms throwing to righty bats to the back foot. So I looked at like slider percentage for righty pitchers against lefty hitters, and the Braves have 3 of the top 8 guys in the league. Like you could really even say 3 of the top 5 if you do minimum 4 starts. Elder, Holmes, and Lopez are all just throwing a ton of sliders to lefties, which is interesting. And if you're smarter than me, you could maybe figure out why. All things considered, I like this Braves team. I like that they have talent that's coming back, hopefully, with the two Spencers at some point. And I like that they have done this without Acuna being a difference maker. He hasn't been bad.
Yeah.
But he's hasn't been good. He's been squarely average. And I feel pretty confident that Ronald Acuna Jr. will get rolling at some point. And when that happens, I think it can keep the Braves going on this hot stretch. Let's quickly talk about the Phillies and then take a break.
So I mentioned that worst run differential in baseball. That is a minus 38, which is just really hard to fathom. You'd think, okay, well, but isn't their pitching pretty good? We know their offense is really struggling outside of Harper and Schwarber, and we can talk about that. But their team ERA is also now down to 4.84, which is 28th in baseball. Their team OPS is actually 24th in baseball at 669. I imagine park adjusted, that's probably actually worse than 24th, which I can check quickly. But that is, I just alluded to it, but besides Harper and Schwarber, this has been a pretty brutal offensive showing. And it's better than the Mets because they at least have those two guys who are getting on base and hitting for power in Harper and Schwarber. But the rest of the line, I mean, Boehm has been a disaster. Yeah. Marsh has been solid. And Justin Crawford, honestly, has pretty much, honestly, has outpaced my expectations for him in the early going. But the rest of it, Adolis has not really helped much. Stott has been struggling a lot. Real Muto just isn't playing very much because he's been injured. And Marchand is not a starting quality catcher whatsoever. So if he's playing more, that's not a good sign. But anything else you've kind of seen from the Phillies lineup in particular?
Yeah, I mean, non-Harper Schwarber Phillies are hitting 214, 282, 319. That is a 601 OPS.
Yep.
That's just simply not good enough. We're still waiting, and it may never happen at this point, for Stott and Boehm in particular to like take anything resembling a leap. But they just need to be closer to sufficient, which they haven't been. And I think they'll get back up to at least league average. Trey Turner is the big one. He started slow. He's supposed to be that third, you know, linchpin alongside Harper and Schwarber, and he just hasn't been that. And so I think that's kind of been that alongside those secondary players not getting going, and then Adolis being fine. Dylan Moore should not be on this roster. I don't know why that's happening. Pitching side has been weird. Like, Jesus Luzardo has been awful. He's had a couple blow-up starts. He's struggling to pitch with runners on base. Christopher Sanchez has been as good as we expected him to be. I think this team will figure things out. It just needs to happen sooner rather than later, or else the Braves are going to open up a division lead that is legitimately imposing, if they haven't already.
Last thing I'll say on the Phillies, as I mentioned, yeah, if you park adjust, 84 OPS plus as a team, which does indeed rank 27th, which is quite bad. On the pitching side, I'm not really that worried about the rotation. Lizardo, yes, he has a 7 ERA or 8 ERA, 30 strikeouts and 5 walks. So I still think the stuff is generally been there for him. I like what I've seen from Nola this year. Sanchez is terrific. Walker, we know, is just not very good. And like, I don't know how they're going to replace him. The bigger concern is that Yoan Duran is
going to replace him with Zach Wheeler. They're going to replace him with Zach Wheeler. Like, right. Wheeler's going to take his spot.
Which is good. And that's another reason why, like, rotation-wise, I'm not concerned. I still think this is going to be one of the best rotations in the league. The bullpen losing Duran, even if it's a brief injury. Keller's been okay. Tim Meza had been really good to start the year.
So
I'm not that worried about the pitching staff. So I just need the rest of the offense to ground into something more competent, and then I think they'll be in a better spot. But they're in a deep hole.
If you look at BABIP, which is, you know, batting average on balls in play, generally thought to end up somewhere around 300 for most players, most teams. The top two players in baseball right now, the top two pitchers with the highest BABIP. Okay, so this is, in a way, you could say these are the two unluckiest pitchers in the league. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but it's a simple way to do it. Jesus Luzardo, 417 BABIP. Christopher Sanchez, 413 BABIP, are 1 and 2. No one else is over 400. In fact, no one else is over 378. Okay? So I expect these two guys to get back on track as far as the surface level numbers are concerned.
And that's awesome because Sanchez has a 1.59 ERA and Luzardo has a 7.94. Right? So whatever, early season nonsense, but it is what it is. Okay, that's the NL East. Let's take a break. When we return, we have three more sweeps. And as we mentioned, we got to give the NL Central some love. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbcast.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We have a couple other sweeps to chat about.
Clean up, everybody.
There is no shame in getting swept.
I never got swept.
You guys got swept.
And we will begin in New York City with the New York Yankees after a very sloppy split with the Angels in the Mike Trout, Aaron Judge show last week. Welcomed the Kansas City Royals, who we're not going to focus too much on today, but they are also in a dark place. And it is not on all the big fancy newspapers that a lot of people read, like the New York Mets. But they also are 7-15 after getting swept by the Yankees. They have lost seven in a row, and things are bad in KC. As for the Yankees, they're pretty good. They are a pretty good baseball team that we are not particularly worried about. Game one, Cam Schlittler. This dude has been terrific. He's going to, if he stays healthy, will likely be in the AL Cy Young conversation. And then the highlight for the Yankees on Friday.
Courtside of the Knicks playoff game.
There you go. Also with the Knicks game. This is really endearing himself even further. We love a good panderer. But also, if you're a Yankee and you can get, you know, Knicks courtside seats, then yeah, you do it.
Yeah, but if you're a Yankee from Boston, you need to make sure people know, right?
That's true. I think he's done that pretty well. But the big highlight for the Yankees on Friday, Ryan McMahon finally does something.
Oh my God.
Big pinch hit home run to take the lead as the Yankees win that one 4-2. They cruise on Saturday and Sunday. Will Warren is fantastic. 11 strikeouts on Saturday. Ben Rice hits a seventh home run. What a surprise. They win 13-4. Ryan Weathers has a really nice outing on Sunday, 7 1/3 scoreless. Cole Reagan's not so much. He allows 7 earned runs. Aaron Judge has his 9th home run. Again, it's like Aaron Judge now at 9 homers. He's fantastic. And Ben Rice is up to 8 homers. Trent Grisham also gets on the board as the Yankees win 7-0. There was some weird stuff with Salvador Perez where Macrotaro benched him, said he... Okay, all right, let's just do this now. I mean, it kind of blew over on Sunday, and I don't know how much to take from it. But it's one of those things that when he's playing poorly and the Royals are playing poorly and he's posting on Instagram being like, he basically... Well,
we got to say what happened.
Quote tweeted. Let's say what happened. So Matt Quatraro benches Salvador Perez on Saturday, I believe, and is like, he needed a mental breather. It's been a tough stretch for him, and we wanted to get Carter Jensen to catch, whatever. Salvador Perez posts that story and Rogers of MLB.com story with the screenshot where it says Perez needed a mental breather, and Salvi posted on Instagram with the caption fake, which is, I don't even really know what to make of that, because it's not like it's real. That is what his manager said. But I think Salvi is communicating that, no, I did not need a mental breather. I would love to play all 162 games. This has been the thing with Salvi for a while now. Even as he's gotten older, he wants to be in there every day, whether he's catching, whether he's DHing. He does not want to miss any games. It's part of what makes him amazing. But he has not been performing recently, and his manager thought he needed a day off. He clearly disagreed. He was back in the lineup on Sunday and I don't think did anything, but he said pregame, like, we're good. It's all good. I'm chilling. I was just frustrated, whatever. So this is one of those things where it's weird in the moment. Is it like a disaster for the Royals? It kind of is, because Salvador Perez is obviously the most important Royal next to Bobby Witt Jr., of course. So this doesn't make you feel good, but is this the number one thing I'm worried about with the Royals? No, it's the fact that they can't hit either. And they're also not pitching nearly as well as we thought they would be.
I'm more concerned than you about this. Under no circumstance should the captain of your team be subtweeting the manager. You also left out that Salvi tweeted, quote, I don't need a mental breather.
Like, this isn't even really subtweeting. This is direct.
This is tweet
acknowledgement.
Direct.
Nothing subtle about this.
Your boss. It's just weird. Look. I understand if Salvi is frustrated with Quatraro saying this. Salvi, like, you got his number, dude. Go to his office. Talk, like, bringing this into public, I thought was a misstep from Salvi's part. And is something doesn't feel right to me with this. They obviously will try and sweep it under the rug and paper it over, and maybe it gets better over time. But something's amiss. I just, and this is just the type of thing, like, under no circumstance should this come out in this way. Like, this is just not the way to handle it. And I expected a little bit better, to be honest with you, from Salvi, who's been around the block a couple times.
I agree with that.
Here's the take. Ready?
Last thing.
Ready?
Yeah.
If you're tweeting, I don't need a mental breather, you might need a mental breather.
Perfectly said. I have nothing to add to that. All I will say about the Royals is they are averaging 3.23 runs per game. That is the worst mark in baseball, just below those New York Mets. And they are 30th in bullpen ERA and WHIP, which we know Carlos Estevez was injured and bad and got crushed in that Atlanta outing, so that probably inflated it. But yeah, they're just not doing a lot of things well. So that is the Kansas City Royals. They are not in a good place. The Yankees are good. They're good. And Gerrit Cole is maybe coming back kind of, maybe sort of soon. I know they're going to take their time. But him and Rodon, it sounds like, are going to be in the rotation in the next, I don't know, month, which is pretty cool because Luis Gil does not look like he should be in the rotation anymore. So Yankees, good ball club. Okay, speaking of good ball clubs, let's talk about what's going on in the NL Central, where we have two more sweeps courtesy of the Cincinnati Reds and the St. Louis Cardinals. Let's go to Minnesota, where Cincinnati went into town and took all three games. Brandon Williamson, a native of the super tiny Fairmont, Minnesota, adding to our discourse about how many friends and family you should have at a ball game. This is an interesting category that I don't think we consider, where you're from a tiny, 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 tiny town. This is not Sal Stewart from Miami or Noah Schultz from a giant Chicago suburb. You go look up where Brandon Williamson is from, and it's like, okay, well, yeah, if he had his whole town there, that actually makes sense, because they're probably like, this is the most proud I've ever been of anything that has happened from our town, Brandon Williamson pitching in the major leagues.
Whoa!
you show Jake, and you look it up on Google Maps, it's like, yep, that's the middle of nowhere. So anyway, Brandon Williamson had a bunch of people there. He's also been sneaky, really solid for the Reds in this rotation. He pitches well on Friday. And yeah, Jake's mind is blown by the size of, what is it, Sherburn?
No.
Sherburn, Minnesota.
Okay, so the Jolly Green Giant, canned veggie company.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think is based next to where Brandon Williamson's from. And there is an enormous statue of the Green Giant the town over that is very creepy. Very creepy.
Okay, well, I look forward to talking to Brandon Williamson about that later on this season. Anyway, Reds win a close one on Friday. Then on Saturday, we have Taj Bradley, who has been terrific, continues to be terrific for Minnesota. 6 innings, 2 earned runs. Still has not allowed a home run this season. He's been very good. But the Reds' bullpen shows up after Andrew Abbott struggles, and they score runs late in the game and win 5-4. Then on Sunday, Bailey Ober is fantastic for the Twins, 10 strikeouts in 6 innings, but the Reds score late again, 3 runs in the 9th, 3 runs in the 10th, and then they win the final out, a successful ABS challenge for a strikeout courtesy of backup catcher PJ Higgins. And that is important for 2 reasons. One, the Reds have been on a effectiveness success, overturn rate. They haven't challenged the most of any team. That's the team they just played, the Minnesota Twins. They have been by far the most successful team at ABS challenges. And PJ Higgins, if you go back and look at the ABS challenge data from AAA in 2025, last season, was so far and away the best catcher at this, it wasn't even close. And now here he is getting a game-ending strike 3 call to win in extra innings to clinch the sweep here for the Cincinnati Reds as they move to 14-8, first place in the NL Central. Still a -8 run differential, but hey, they are winning baseball games. Their pitching is getting the job done. There were zero home runs hit by either team in this 3-game series, which is not as rare as I thought it was. Shout out to Sarah Langs, the GOAT, for looking this up for me. Did happen with the Reds and Pirates. The Reds again. The Reds, not big fan of home runs. They did it last season, but yeah, they're finding ways to win close ball games, and I think we have to take them seriously, as we apparently have to take the entire NL Central seriously. Is there anything else about the Reds and the Twins before we talk about the Cardinals and Astros?
Cardinals taking all 3 games over the Houston Astros, who are wearing it, dude. Game 1, Cards exploded for 5 runs late on homers from Yvonne Herrera, Nolan Gorman. Very interesting start for Peter Lambert of the Astros, who got a ton of swing and miss, but also lost. Yordan hits his 8th of the year. Cards win 9-4. Game 2, Andre Pallante, solid. Lance McCullers, ineffective. Mason Wynn, Burleson, go yard. Yordan, homers again. Cardinals win 7-5. This is very like very Ohtani on the Angels. Yordan homers. Oh, yeah. Astros lose. Game 3. Guess what happened? Yordan homers. Astros lose. 7-5 again. Cardinals taking all 3. Mike Burrow's disappointing for Houston. All of their pitching additions have been disastrous. And they find themselves adrift with the second worst record in the American League. They are 8-15. And I assume, yes, last place in the NL West. What's the latest the Astros have been in last place in the NL West over the last decade?
Interesting
to know.
They did this 2 years ago.
Oh, they did had a pretty
horrific start. So I guess there's some comfort in that. But in general, the pitching has been so atrocious. Their team ERA is now 6.11, which is last in baseball by such a ridiculous margin. The Nats are at 5.65. And then I guess we mentioned the Phillies earlier, Cardinals and White Sox. Cardinals, the team they just played, are also way down there. But the Cardinals going into Houston and taking all 3 and being like, hey, remember when you were in the NL Central? Don't you wish you were still in the NL Central? Although I guess in this case, it's a good thing the Astros are not still in the NL Central, because in that case, they'd be way farther behind than they actually are in the extremely mid AL West. But good for the Cardinals, man. We've kind of mentioned it a few times this season. They don't suck, and their pitching is not awesome, but they got enough going well on the offensive side, and especially in a weekend like this where I don't think Jordan Walker homered. Right. So they got some offense from some of the other guys, seeing Wynn get involved, seeing Burleson get involved, Herrera, who we're big fans of. So they are also have a really good record, 13-8, still a negative run differential. But last thing on the Astros, they're coming to Cleveland this week, so I'll get an up close look at them. But yeah, this Yordan Alvarez season is preposterous. Here are the lowest strikeout rates in baseball. All right. Luis Arraez. He doesn't hit a lot of home runs. Liam Hicks. We love Liam Hicks, but he also doesn't hit a lot of home runs, although he does have 4. So good for him. Ernie Clement, Chandler Simpson, Xander Bogaerts, not exactly a slugger anymore, Nico Horner, and then Yordan Alvarez as the 7th lowest strikeout rate in baseball, and is also slugging 790 with 10 home runs. So, yeah, I mean, he now that Juan Soto is chilling on the injured list and Aaron Judge is still kind of getting going, this is the best hitter on the planet right now. And I don't really feel bad saying that. He has been in the conversation for that before, but he's right there. You can say it's Judge. You can say it's Soto. You can say it's Ohtani, et cetera, et cetera. But right now you can say with a straight face, yeah, that's the best hitter on the planet. And the numbers will tell you, yeah, you're probably right. So I'm looking forward to seeing him in person and talking to people about him, because he is amazing, even if the Astros are not.
Houston's pitching is really bad, dude. And we really thought, we believed in the operation to just find outs. The new additions have been just so bad. So Imai is having a terrible time and is on the IL. And then the dudes that they went and added over the winter alongside Imai, Christian Roa, Mike Burrows, Ryan Weiss, Peter Lambert, all 4 of those dudes have opponent batting averages over 300. They're all, Ryan Weiss has an opponent's OPS of 981.
Oh my God.
Okay. Yeah. Mike Burrows, 877. Like, I am not feeling good about the Astros.
Well, and this is the thing. Burrows and Imai, if they were the 3 and the 4 starters or the 4 and the 5 starters,
yeah.
Okay, let's work through it. Let's be patient. If Hunter Brown and Javier are out with shoulder strains for completely unclear amounts of time, it could be another 3 weeks. It could be another 3 months. Like, we have no idea. They literally can't afford it. Like, they're just going to be hemorrhaging runs to a degree. And when your bullpen is not anywhere near as nails as it has been, Josh Hader hasn't thrown a pitch this season. Remember him? And Abreu's been a disaster. So they just, the offense is good. It's not just Yordan. It ain't good enough if you have essentially, production-wise, the worst pitching staff in baseball. Is it true talent the worst pitching staff in baseball? No, but it's not that far off when they're this injured. So I don't know. I don't know how they dig their way out of it. As for the Cardinals, they find themselves near the top of the NL Central, which is the entire division is 3 games over 500, at least, right? So the Brewers and Cubs are currently tied for last. at 12-9 with the Pirates in third at 13-9. Those three teams have way better run differentials than the Reds and Cardinals. And that brings us to the other two teams in this division who we haven't talked about yet, the Brewers and the Pirates, who also won series over the weekend. So let's talk about them. What happened with Milwaukee?
So the Brewers win the first two games of the set. We don't need to get in the nitty-gritty. Jake Bowers is hitting incredibly well, longtime friend of the program, someone who I accidentally send grocery lists and workout programs to. Good to see him hitting the ball hard. Brewers win the first game 7-5. Game two, Brandon Woodruff is awesome. 7 innings, 1 run. Sandy's fine, but 6 walks, 1K, not fine. He only allows a couple runs, but Brewers win anyway, 5-2. Game three, Kyle Stowers comes back, gets 2 hits. Yuri Perez is good, thank God. He'd been really scuffling to start the year. Marlins win 5-3. Brewers, though, after a little schneid earlier in the year, getting back on track this weekend in Miami. Pirates-Rays series was fun. It was like a reunion for all the dudes that have ever been traded between these two teams who feel like they're trading like all the time. Bubba Chandler was good, which, similar to Yuri Perez, was something of a relief after looking iffy to start the season. O'Neill Cruz goes yard in that opening game. Game two was a mess. Long rain delay, 4-hour, 12-inning game. Paul Skeens only throws 4 innings because of the rain. ERA down to 3.27. Love that. Love that for Paul after his opening day disaster fest. The Rays outlast the Pirates with like 2 people in the stadium because it was so gross out. Game three, Shane McClanahan, not great. Mitch Keller, pretty great. 7 innings, 2 earned. Pirates win that 6-3. One highlight from this series, Jordan, did you see Jake Mangum's viral moment?
I did. This was, you know, we're now crusty, old, grumpy people in our 30s. So sometimes these moments don't exactly hit the same as they did when we were a little bit younger. Yeah. This is it. This is 80 grade. This is what it's all about.
So here's the deal. A Twitter account called Dudes Posting Their W's, which has 2.8 million followers, tweeted an MLB player tosses a ball to a kid wearing his jersey. Kid makes the catch, then hands it to his little sister and gives her a hug. I mean, this has been viewed a preposterous amount of times, right? Some incorrect facts, believe it or not, from the account with 2.8 million followers. The kid who catches the ball is wearing a Team USA Paul Skeens jersey. His little sister, it appears, is wearing a Jake Mangum jersey. He hands the ball over to her. Now, the reason this is great is this tweet understands it. An MLB player tossing a ball to a kid wearing his jersey, this happens all the time, okay? There being a Jake Mangum jersey in the crowd already is hilarious and nuts. And Jake Mangum said as much after the game. Jake Mangum, who is Pittsburgh's 4th outfielder and like just got there after being traded from Tampa over the winter. If I was Jake Mangum and I was in the outfield and I saw a kid wearing my jersey, I'd be like, yes, I'll give you 20 balls. I'll give you a bat. I mean, what an improbability. And good for Jake Mangum for making this moment happen.
And that's why, right, Jake's like, yeah, that's who I'm throwing it to. And a nice toss from there. That was not an easy on the second level there in left field. But yep, that was awesome. Jake Mangum, a nice fellow. And I'll just say a very basic point here. I know Saturday was a mess. The weather was a disaster. The umbrellas were flying all over the place. And that was definitely a frustrating. I'm sure there's people in the Pirates clubhouse being like, that sucks. We should have swept. Totally fair statement. At the same time, if this is going to be a season where the Pirates are a good baseball team, this was a nice series win. You have that crushing loss on Saturday, but you're just like, you know what? It's fine. We're better than the Rays. Let's just go out and beat them on Sunday. And that's what they did. And now it's like, okay, Pirates, we can take you seriously. Like, you look like you are pretty competent. So I'm intrigued by them and this whole division. I think it's been one of the biggest stories in the league so far. Even if the run differential doesn't really make a whole lot of sense right now, all these teams are within 2 games of each other. And I look forward to seeing how it shakes out, because I'm really not sure who I actually believe in the most. And it would be cool to see if 5 teams can stay close together for even a few months would be compelling, because I can't really remember the last time I've seen something quite like that. Even in the AL East, usually there's at least one team that's way fallen behind. I know we've seen more like three or four teams jockeying, but yeah, NL Central, shockingly very, very, very fun. All right, one more series before we take a break, and then we'll go fast at the end. The Giants were in Washington, D.C., and took the first couple of games over the Washington Nationals before Miles Michaelis said, not so fast, as he goes four scoreless after the P.J. Poulin opener. 2026 Nats, everybody. Robbie Ray was just okay. Giants offense asleep. We've seen that before. Curtis Meade homers as the Nationals win 3-0. But I know you were there to kind of get an up-close look at the Tony Vitello experience. I spent a good amount of time around the Giants in spring training, but I have not seen the Giants up close since the season began. So just wanted to kind of give you the rock here and give us some Tony V takeaways before we take a break.
It is so interesting, the whole Tony V dynamic, right? Comes over from the University of Tennessee, college baseball lifer, baseball coaching icon, wins a national championship, turns Knoxville into a baseball juggernaut, jumps over to pro ball to lead the Giants, making a move that no one has made in the history of the sport to that extent. And the thing that struck me, even though the Giants won the first two games of the series, was Tony Vitello learning how to lose. There's so many different adjustments that he has to make going from college to the pros. But the biggest, I think, in my opinion, is the constantness, whatever that word is, of the baseball season. You're playing every day, man. The season is 162 games. Tony Vitello will experience more losing and more winning this season than in any previous year of his coaching life. And that sheer amount of feeling, of emotion, is something that he's going to learn how to handle. And I talked to him about this, and he was like, frankly, it has been difficult. It has been difficult to not let the losses overwhelm you, because at the college level, each loss feels more important because each loss is more important. In a 55-game season, that's a third of an MLB season. And so each win feels like you swept a team. Each loss feels like you got swept. And so you not overreact, but you have to be more aggressive with how you make moves and how you shuffle personnel, et cetera, et cetera. And so Vitello is kind of learning how to not overreact to that. And predictably, he was honest when talking about this, but him learning how to lose is going to be crucial in order for him to learn how to win, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I also think he's also learning how to manage, because there's just a lot of, less so in this series, but if you watched the series in Cincinnati last week, like, there was a whole lot of weird stuff going on. And I'm not talking about the beanball wars. I'm talking about just like not challenging when TJ Friedl obviously dropped the ball. Some of the pitching decisions, like, he is still figuring this stuff out. And unfortunately, the Giants are not really, is Tony V the problem? Is he the reason why they're 9-13 and not very good? I don't think so, but he's still part of this. He's part of the calculus of how good are the Giants are going to be when he's clearly making a lot of big decisions. He is shaking up the lineup like crazy. He is using his relievers in very strange situations. So he is making an impact on this team, for better or for worse. And we will see if he can kind of handle all that. And if the baseball players are good enough for them to remain relevant. They are about to play the Dodgers for the first time this season. They welcome them to San Francisco for a three-game series starting on Tuesday. We're going to take a break. When we return, seven more series, we're going to go super fast. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Seven more series to go. Let's go fast.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Do you believe in miracles? Yes. Colorado Rockies take 2 out of 3 from the two-time defending champion Dodgers. And today, they have a chance to secure that history in Game 4 and win the series. What happened over the weekend at Coors, Jordan, besides snow?
It was real cold on Friday, and the Dodgers took that one. Tyler Glasnow was awesome. Max Muncy hit 2 home runs. The coldest game in Dodgers history, 35 degrees, and they got the dub. No problem there. But on Saturday, the Rockies strike back. Friend of the program, Dalton Rushing, hits his 5th homer of the season. Kyle Tucker goes yard, but the Rockies are feisty. They fight back, and their bullpen is great as they take that one 4-3. Then on Sunday, Roki Sasaki struggles. Roki Sasaki and Coors didn't go great. But here's the thing. Roki struggles. He was not even in the top 2 worst pitching performances of the day, as neither Blake Treinen nor Edwin Diaz can record a single out. Both of them allow 3 earned runs. We got homers from Kyle Karros and Mickey Moniak. Victor Vodnik closes the door late. They win 9-6. Couple interesting things in this one. Quickly, let's just do Ryan Ward. Congratulations to Ryan Ward, the pride of Bryant University, who played 420 AAA games with the Oklahoma City Dodgers before finally getting the call because Freddie Freeman had another child. This is just an awesome story. He gets 2 hits in his debut. This dude would have been in the big leagues 2 years ago with probably 22 teams, but this is just how it works. If you're a Dodger and you're kind of in that in-between of not quite good enough, not quite reliable enough, not playing the right positions to get to the majors, he has been stuck, but he finally made his debut, so happy for him. Otherwise, not the best look for the Dodgers over these couple of games, both on the field where they had some pitching disasters, and then off the field where after they lost on Saturday, where Dalton Rushing was starting behind the plate, Dalton goes to the media and is like, I don't know, what's going on with them swinging at first pitches? It's a little fishy, blah, blah, blah. Dalton, we love you. What are we doing? Come on, dude. Like, the Rockies are swinging at more first pitches than any team in baseball. That has been true the whole season. And sometimes you throw bad pitches, which is basically what Dave Roberts said. He was like, we threw some bad breaking balls. He's like, that's allowed. The other team's allowed to beat you. That's okay.
That is true. And then the Rockies went ahead and made fun of Dalton, which I thought was some cheeky behavior. After Dalton said that things were fishy, the Rockies employed a gone fishing hit celebration where they started reeling in towards the dugout.
This is great work. I think this is great work.
Great job.
Honestly.
The vibes in Colorado, I don't know how much better this team is going to be. The vibes are undeniably better. One more thing to talk about here with the Dodgers. The Edwin Diaz situation is very odd, where no one felt more volatility proof in the world of relief pitching than Edwin Diaz, and yet here we are. He hadn't pitched in like 9 days, and he comes out and he can't get it out, and his stuff is down across the board. Will he be healthy and ready to go in October? I'm sure. But right now, things are odd with Edwin Diaz, who was a huge part of LA's quest to 3-peat.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's the concerns have to do with his knee, which he of course injured in the WBC celebration. It's a lower body thing, and that seems to be impacting his ability, his explosiveness, and just his velocity. So, and then obviously his command. So I don't know what the plan is, but he keeps saying, I'm fine, I'm good, I want to pitch. And they're like, no, we should take it easy. So not awesome there, but the Dodgers still have the best record in baseball. They'll be fine.
Friend of the program and former producer of this show, Bobby Wagner, with a great point about this, which is, have they checked the length of his legs? Remember that 1 year Eddie D got off to a slow start? And then the Mets trainer was like, hey, your leg is longer than your other leg. Let's pop the leg back into place. And then he was dominant from there on out. They should check his legs. Great point, Bobby. Speaking of teams that should get checked out, the Boston Red Sox, they are playing in 10 minutes because it's Patriots Day, Marathon Day in Boston. That weird, wonky 11 a.m. start at Fenway Park. They lost 2 out of 3 to start the series against Detroit. They win the opener behind 8 scoreless for Major Suarez. Game goes 0-0 into extra innings. They win on a walk-off chopper from Masataka Yoshida. But not scoring a run in regulation is not a good sign for an offense that is underwhelmed, as Tarek Skubal is incredible in game 2, striking out 10, allowing 1 earned run. Kerry Carpenter goes yabo. They win 4-1. And then Garrett Crochet shaky again on Sunday. Good for the first 4, and then gives up bombs in the 5th to Jermai Jones and Dylan Dingler. Fromber's great. The Red Sox are hitting Andrew Monasterio in the 2-hole. I know it's like a thing against lefties. That can't be the plan. And things are very weird right now for the Red Sox, who have not gotten rolling yet. They are being helped out by the Mets and the Phillies' ineptitudes, where they are not the story, but maybe they should be if they continue to lose. They will be in Baltimore this weekend, so I will get eyes on them.
And the Blue Jays are obviously also 8-13. So there's a lot of other teams struggling that we have not. And we had a little period where it was like, oh my God, look at the Red Sox. They're a mess. But they're not even on the podium right now for teams in the biggest absolute mess. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Ever heard of it? Where no. The Guardians take 3 out of 4 over the Baltimore Orioles. That begins on Thursday with something we didn't even mention on Friday. Parker Messick almost threw a no-hitter. Leody Taveras said no, no, no to lead off the ninth inning, but Parker Messick is legit, and I could have told you that before the season even started. He is fantastic. Guardians win that one 4-2 after the Orioles' late rally comes up short. Then on Friday, Orioles respond. Schneeman hits a grand slam off Anthony Nunez. Here come the Guardians. Just kidding. Here come the Orioles. 6 runs in the top of the eighth as they go on to win that one 6-4. But it's all Gardos the rest of the way. Gavin Williams was tremendous on Saturday. And then Jose Ramirez homers twice on Sunday off Trevor Rogers. And congratulations to Austin Hedges, who got engaged after the game on Sunday. Looking forward to asking around today when I'm at the ballpark about just like the exact sequence of events for how this happened and the timing and whatnot. But congrats to Austin Hedges. Very happy.
Would he have done this after a loss? Would
sounds like no, based on the like way no. He talked about it. Yeah.
It's funny also because I know that Austin Hedges is not the most prolific hitter, but he did go 0-for-4 in this game with 2 strikeouts. But he was like, I'm Austin Hedges. I caught a great game back there. I overturned some ABS calls, you know? So will you marry me?
She's like, oh my God, he knows the zone so well, at least when he's catching. Yes, last thing on this series, Taylor Ward and Bo Naylor, I should mention, but definitely Taylor Ward finally hit a home run. And this is last call here because I think later this week, folks, we're doing Why Haven't You Homered Yet? It is about time. There are still some big names. There are some big names that have not hit a home run yet this season. But Taylor Ward finally gets on the board. Congratulations to him. Let's go to Arizona, where the D-backs take 2 out of 3 over the Toronto Blue Jays. Mike Soroka, good for him. He pitched very well on Friday. Eric Lauer was the bulk guy after an opener and was not happy about it. He complained about it afterwards, and John Schneider was like, I'm the manager. Sorry, dude. Deal with it. Game correct two. Answer. Correct answer. Jeff Hoffman has a really tough outing in the eighth as he allows a bunch of base runners, and then Corbin Carroll hits a go-ahead grand slam. Corbin Carroll, really good at baseball. But then on Sunday, uh-oh, are the Blue Jays going to get swept? Don't have to worry about that as they score 8 runs in the top of the first inning. I believe tying a franchise record, Ryan Nelson only records 1 out, and the Blue Jays cruise 10-4. However, this is the 6th series loss for the Blue Jays. That is the most series losses in Major League Baseball. They are 8-13.
They are a weird team. They have the lowest strikeout rate as a lineup in Major League Baseball right now, and yet they're not walking at all. Probably because my guess would be a lot of early count contact. The pitching staff has been unlucky and also not that good and also injured. I think I came into the year higher on Boston than Toronto, but I'm probably more worried about Boston than Toronto based upon their early season starts. Let's go out to Yolo County, where the White Sox took 2 out of 3 over the A's, winning 9-2 in the opener with a Murakami long ball. A's bounce back in game two, winning 7-6 as Jacob Wilson and Nick Kurtz go yard. Both were off the slow start, so it's good to see those guys heating up. Game three, White Sox clobber Jeffrey Springs for 7 earned homers from a quartet of White Sox, including Murakami. Noah Schultz in his second career start, much better than his opener. Probably should talk about Murakami, who has been one of the weirder players in baseball this year. I think it has gone how we expected, where he's just hitting home runs in the Joey Gallo fashion. I mean, what do you make of it? Is he a good player? Yes.
He is
doing
exactly what you... This is... We are at right now I think, a like 90th percentile outcome for what you could hope this rookie season to be.
Correct.
He is doing a Kyle Schwarber impression where he has the highest whiff rate in baseball, one of the highest strikeout rates, but he's walking 21% of the time, which is also one of the highest rates. And when he's making contact, he's absolutely pulverizing the ball. He has made some contact with, he has crushed some high velocity fastballs. He's obviously pulling the baseball in the air quite effectively. He's getting the ball in the air and he's doing damage on the pitches he can do damage with. And that's fine. Like, it's been extreme, but it's working. So how can I possibly complain, especially in this White Sox offense that has been awful so far? Like, this version, of course, sure. this version is essentially impossible to sustain over a whole season because he's at like a 65% three true outcome percentage, which really is just Joey Gallo territory. But it's working, and I have to think what his approach is. He is showing us something. I you got to feel good about this. I'm pretty excited about it.
Great email from Jimmy, who says, through the first 22 games of the year, he has 15 hits, 8 are home runs. Seems like he just flicks the bat and the ball explodes with incredible, maybe divine power. Interesting.
That's true.
How many homers does he need to be rookie of the year if he's batting 200? I think if he hits 45, he'll be fine. Like, maybe even 40.
This is
one of the most all-time... he's on pace for like an extreme three true outcome season. The ones that come to mind, like Mark McGwire had a couple wild ones. And then I think the one that I think Ryan Schimpf, if that's a name people remember.
Yes. That was only 300 plate appearances, but yes.
Even fewer. 2017, Ryan Schimpf had 14 home runs and 26 hits.
But then what was the strikeouts and walk rate? Because that's what's really relevant. It's not just home runs per hit. I mean, that's also part of it.
Yeah, I was more just thinking the hit.
Oh, sure. Home run per at bat or percentage. Yeah, I mean, that's... And if we're talking rookie of the year, like, his bigger challenges are going to be Chase DeLauder and Kevin McGonigal more than exactly how many home runs he hits. But no, this has been awesome. I've had so much fun watching this. I'm glad that even though... teams are going to figure out like, oh, this is where he's whiffing literally every time as opposed to only most of the time.
Right.
He's going to have some ugly skids here. But for now, like, this is great. I'm happy for him. And I think he has shown me something that makes me feel more encouraged about where this is going.
One last piece of White Sox news. This was an email we got from Eric, who highlighted something important for me. Some news about the Pope. My preseason bold prediction was Pope at a game. And while we may not get Pope at a White Sox game, we are getting Pope at a game. Pope Leo is anticipated to be in attendance for Notre Dame and Villanova's college basketball doubleheader in Rome on November 1st. So if we get a game, if we get the White Sox to play in Rome, he'll go. If we bring it, he will come.
That's good. All right, MLB. Let's not bother with the London game or go back to... Australia, like,
Coliseum.
Let's just go. Hey,
Coliseum.
Did Team Italy not show us? Like, what more do you want to see? What more do you want to see?
Dude, White Sox, Royals, in Rome.
We're going to need the Royals to start. We're going to need Vinny and Cags to start playing a little bit better before we send them, before we reward them with a game in their homeland. Okay, two more series before we say goodbye, before we talk about the Sabres. The Mariners take 2 out of 3 over the Texas Rangers. Rangers win 5-0 on Friday. DeGrom needs 88 pitches to get through 4 scoreless innings, but the Mariners offense does nothing. But the Mariners pitching continues to be terrific. They bounce back with great starts from George Kirby and Brian Wu. Mariners win 7-3 on Saturday and 5-2 on Sunday as Rob Refsnyder gets his first hit as a Mariner. The first pitch of the game off Mackenzie Gore is a home run. JP and Randy follow with homers. 3 home runs against Mackenzie Gore as the Mariners win that one 5-2. Much needed good series victory for the Mariners, who have the second lowest ERA in baseball and they're still trying to figure out how to score runs consistently. Let's finish in Anaheim, where the San Diego Padres took 2 out of 3 over the Angels. Mike Trout's homer streak comes to an end on Friday night, but the Angels do win the series opener with another terrific start from Jose Soriano, who has been amazing and would win the Cy Young if the season ended today. They win 8-0 on Friday. However, the Padres bounce back with some close wins on Saturday and Sunday. Mason Miller with saves in both of those games. Not a lot of offense from San Diego this weekend, but they still come out with the series victory, as the Padres are now 15-7, so just a half game behind the Los Angeles Dodgers, who they don't play until like mid-May, which sucks. But Padres are hanging around, man. They are seemingly a pretty damn good baseball team, so good for them. But we did want to finish before we say goodbye, particularly with the Angels. Some very sad news that came down, I guess, a little bit after we recorded, I believe, on Friday, which is the death of Garrett Anderson, who is one of the greatest players in franchise history. Passed away at the age of 53, I believe, according from a heart attack, which is, of course, just awful. And Garrett Anderson, by all accounts, amazing player with the Angels, but certainly a human being that clearly touched a lot of people around the game in a very meaningful way. And a sudden loss like this is awful. We've lost a few kind of baseball people who have been in baseball lifers, Davey Lopes, Phil Garner. I know we haven't taken a lot of time to talk about those. So our apologies on that front. But Garrett Anderson is one, a player that I remember watching Garrett Anderson, you know, like not someone necessarily meant a lot to me, but this is a player that I certainly remember being like, yeah, that guy's on the Angels. That guy's really good and heck of a career. And clearly someone that I think he has the record for games played with the Angels, if I'm not wrong. And he's clearly someone that means a lot to this franchise. So I know that it was an emotional game on Friday for the Angels franchise as a whole.
There was a great clip going around of rapper Schoolboy Q talking about Garrett Anderson. Did you see this?
I did not.
So he was basically talking. It was like an old clip of him on like one of those morning talk show type deals where he's asked, like, why are you an Angels fan? And he's like, I grew up on the same street as Garrett Anderson, and Garrett Anderson used to come around and give away free tickets in L.A. And Garrett Anderson's dad lived on that street and got Schoolboy Q into baseball, like had him playing Little League. And it was just like a cool example of how fandom can work and interest in baseball can work, where like if you're a big leaguer and you go to your street where you live and you give away tickets, like, you can turn someone in the very blue part of LA into an Angels fan. And so that kind of struck me as kind of a special vignette of what seemed like a very special person. Jordan, that is our show. Yeah. Yep. Thank you to TJ Brassel and Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you to the Buffalo freaking Sabres for an electrifying, invigorating evening of playoff hockey. Sabres going down 2-0, a sluggish performance until TNT Tage Thompson rescues a city and these two podcasters from woe. What an atmosphere it was last night in Buffalo. Some of the clips, just incredible stuff. Friend of the program, Mike Monaco, on the call for ESPN. Just unhealthy levels of hype yesterday evening. This journey has been everything we ever could have dreamed of. And yeah, dude, that's just one game. You're telling me I gotta do this for the next month and a half?
Oh my goodness.
Hopefully.
Oh, that was right. You got the whole spectrum there of playoff hockey. And man, that Samuelson goal was something else. So I don't know how much longer do we have to wait before they play again. Is it like the NBA where they take a bajillion off days and it takes forever for them to play again? But I don't know. We just know we're looking forward to the next Sabres playoff game. It has been so much fun following this team. And thank you to the Sabres fans who have welcomed us into this ridiculous fandom to any possible degree. Because it is not about us. It is about the people of Buffalo. But we are certainly enjoying having watched this team all season long. And wow, what a thing. All right. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. We will be back on Wednesday. Will the Mets have won a baseball game by then? Well, we'll see about that. Thanks for listening. Bye.